Welcome to episode 59 of Aminal's World. How are you all doing? This week, I had the honor of interviewing Asma Khan on my podcast. We've been trying to organize this for almost 2 years. I still remember the initial plan was to film this interview live at her restaurant last year, but then we went into lockdown and then it never happened. But here we are, and I'm so, so glad you all get a chance to listen to this. If you do enjoy these episodes, please remember to subscribe. And if you are on iTunes, please do leave a review as it will help us reach out to a much wider audience. And of course, you can help in the more traditional way of just telling your friends and family about this podcast, because I'm sure these conversations can help everybody in some way or another. And just before we go into the show, you can also find all my previous episodes on my website, aminalviz.com, where I also have an option for you to subscribe to my newsletter. So ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, here's a lovely Asma Khan. Welcome to the show, Asma. It's so lovely to finally get to do this.
Thank you very much. And I've always wanted to, you know, I knew you do this podcast. And since I saw your story in the Vogue, I thought, you know, this is something quite remarkable. I mean, of course, I knew the build-up to all the work you were doing. So this is an honor to talk to you. Thank you.
Asma, I've got a medical degree, I've got a young baby, I took the government to court, but I think today my mom is finally proud of me that I'm talking to Asma Khan. So thank you for joining me. I know how busy you are, and you've got your new cookbook out as well. Have you ever dreamed that you'd have 2 cookbooks out to the world?
No, because the thing is that, you know, you come from the same tradition as I do. You know how bad mothers are and aunts are explaining how to cook. So to think that you can actually write down these recipes was almost impossible. But I was so keen to actually get my kid to cook, my older one. I started trying to write down and explain things and breaking it down for him. And I think that really helped. He just wanted to know. It was a kind of more a theoretical thing. He wanted to know how to cook this. He wasn't going to do it. But I taught myself how to write a recipe. And it does feel incredible to have 2 cookbooks. I mean, very soon I'll have 2 books out.
Asma, you moved to the UK, I would say about 20 years ago. Is that right? You moved here 30 years ago. And when you moved to the UK 30 years ago, do you feel the UK is different now to what it was at that time?
Yes. Different in some ways and not so different in other ways. The one very obvious way that it is different is because I remember, you know, the excitement when fresh ginger was available in Sainsbury's. You didn't get anything in Cambridge. And if you wanted anything, you had to walk a lot to go to a Pakistani shop to buy the ingredients or come into London. So of course, now you get, you know, all kinds of spices and ingredients in every supermarket. So that is there, that, you know, there's easy accessibility to all our ingredients. But in the other way, I feel that the attitude that people had towards curry houses, you know, at that time, the street corner, with, you know, invariably run by Saletis, they loved it, but they were so racist and dismissive of these people, you know, these Bangladeshis who were just, you know, not cooking authentic food. The racism that I saw from the Indians towards the Bangladeshis, that still remains. That hasn't changed. And the other thing is this separation of culture and food, which I saw then, that was because of ignorance. People had no clue. They found, you know, our food exotic and unusual. You know, but over 30 years, travel costs have come down. There's the internet. People have a lot of knowledge. There are people who are speaking up like you about, you know, issues that are important. You have a generation of people who aren't afraid to speak up. Yet, when it comes to food, I see that culture and food are still separated. This allows our food to be appropriated in ways that are not respectful. You can be from Mars and cook my food. I don't mind. But you better be educated about my culture. That is the main thing, that, you know, you cook without respect. You are sneering and dismissive. And I've said this many times. You cannot have my food and not take me. You cannot wear my clothes. You cannot listen to my music. You cannot take part of my culture. These are the easy things. I want you to talk about the empire. I want to talk about slavery. I want to talk about the things that you will not teach in school, as if it didn't happen. You know, Tudor history is as important as what happened in the empire. But when children leave school, they have no knowledge why people like you and me who look like you and me, the story of your father. You know, these are important stories to tell them. And this is why I think things have changed, but they've also not changed. But I'm optimistic still, because I've seen that there has been some progress and people are more willing to understand and try and engage with people who look different from them.
When you came 30 years ago, Asma, you had an arranged marriage. And may I ask, how many times did you meet your husband before you actually married him?
I spent quite a lot of time continuously with him before I got married. And then before he moved back to Cambridge and came back to get married. I knew for sure that this is what I wanted. And, you know, of course, you know, you know better that arranged marriages and forced marriages are different things. Mm-hmm. A lot of people still don't understand this. And this is unfortunate that we've not been able to explain this. Arranged marriage, it works exactly like Tinder, and it works exactly like a dating app. Just that you have some crazy mad auntie in between who does the connecting. This is the low-tech way of connecting people. It works exactly in the same way. And, you know, people who go out and meet people in bars and pubs invariably are going to the same kinds of jobs or have been to similar schools. And this is how, you know, they end up, you know, in a relationship. Mm. So not in defense of arranged marriages, I just think that, you know, people don't understand. And this has to do with a lot with prejudice and ignorance. But yeah, I knew, you know, what he did, and I knew, you know, that he was intelligent. And that was good enough for me as a starting point. I think that, you know, you don't really know someone till you actually move in with them and what they're like. So I think that, you know, I knew enough that I was going to be able to survive. I don't think the credit for a 30-year marriage should go to him, because he's been very tolerant. I'm not the easiest person to live with. And not also, I haven't been at home. I'm quite messy and, you know, not having any meals at home. So I think that, you know, if he had thought he was going for a traditional arranged marriage where someone would be making roti for him every day when he came back from work, that ain't happening at all. So it works both ways, you know. I think the expectations in an arranged marriage are very low. You don't know what the other person is going to be like. In some ways, that's good, because you don't have this kind of broken expectations of what you thought this person was, because you don't know this person.
Asma, I think I read somewhere that your father is from North Indian heritage and your mother is Bengali. Is that right?
Yeah. So my father's from the north, my mother's from the east. Yeah.
And was that marriage also arranged? Because it's like the different parts of India. So I was just wondering, was this marriage usual at that time?
No, it was very unusual. In my mother's side of the family, everyone marries within their clan. They all marry people who look like them, who are like them. They're related distantly. In my father's side of the family, the same situation. My father's a Muslim Rajput. They never married outside. And my mother's family, they were all married within their own extended families. And this was made more complicated by the fact that my grandfather, three brothers, married three sisters. You know, so after that, they just married into each other's family. This is quite common among, you know, Indian Muslims. Not that, you know, this is just a comfort zone. You know that for sure this person, you've seen them growing up. But my father's and my mother's marriage was very unusual because my grandfather, who was my father's landlord, had five daughters. I think he just saw this as an opportunity to get his one daughter married off. And my grandmother, who was an outsider, my dadi, my paternal grandmother, I think possibly agreed to this marriage to punish the rest of my father's family, because she was always treated like an outsider. And she thought, fine, I'm going to get the ultimate outsider, a Bengali, into this family. I'm actually quite sure this is the situation, because otherwise this marriage wouldn't have happened. My grandmother, who was Punjabi, decided to inflict inflict a Bengali onto my father's family, who were all very kind of, you know, Rajput and very different tradition. So I think it was quite a challenge for both my parents, coming from very, very different backgrounds. Just purely for the fact my father only ate roti, my mother only ate rice. Just mm-hmm. This rice and roti eating culture was so different. But they've done a great job raising the three of us, and, you know, still together. And but it was very unusual. And this was really, hasn't been repeated in the family, either side. This kind of getting a Rajput married to a Bengali doesn't work.
And Asma, I believe that your mother also had a catering business, which also inspired you to, when you started your supper clubs, to sort of cook in bulk, and you learned from her as well. Was it normal at that time for women in the family to work? Because I just had a moment yesterday, a light bulb moment. I was talking to Nishant. I said, I think I'm the first woman in my whole family from both sides in any generation to be a working mother.
Yeah. No, it was... My mother is the first person in both sides of the family to be a working mother. She had three children under the age of 12. My brother was very young. She started working because it was very tight for us financially. My father had a job, but she had three children. And she started working to support the family. And I can understand, you know, why she did that. And so she's the first businesswoman, working mother in both sides of the family, a food entrepreneur at a time when it was considered so wrong to be out at night without your husband. And she would come back at 3 a.m. in a tempo, which is like a kind of, you know, with all the food and the cooks. When she went out for events, she stayed till the very end and packed up and came back to the staff. And nobody dared say anything because she managed to do the quite impossible thing, and which I find very inspirational. While I was writing the book, I realized how much I had learned from her. I am immersed in my culture, yet I'm willing to take on things that are uncomfortable, just like you did. You know, you are a medic. You took the government to court and you won. And I think that, you know, you should be unafraid to be who you are, you know, to be the color of skin you are. That's really important. You know, so people never now ask me, you know, I walk into a room, I can see on the tray of champagne, there's one glass of orange juice. That is for me. I don't drink. This is, you've got to accept me, you know, as what I am. And I think my mother just was so traditional in lots of ways, the way she treated the family, the way she raised us. Yet, you know, the fact that she was out every night, you know, working and doing something that no one had done before, I think people couldn't throw stones. That's the big thing, you know, and I know that this is what happened with me as well, that here it is the, you know, not people of my culture, but people who are not of my culture, questioning my right to be on stage, to have the platform I do. You saw this the most with Chef's Table, where the announcement was made that I was the first British chef, Netflix's Chef's Table, who had never featured anyone in the United Kingdom. I expected to be trolled. Not a single person wrote on social media, oh, you're not very British. What's so British about you? But by then, I had made it very clear. I would drag you through the floor if you asked me my right to be who I am. Maybe that was a thing, I think also could have been age. I think younger girls get trolled more. If you are younger, you get trolled more, but whatever, it didn't happen. This, you know how unusual that is. Mm. Your right to be called British, your right to hold a British passport is constantly questioned. But, you know, and I know that my children have gone through this, you know, where are you really from? Where are you really, really from? You know, I heard Riz rapping this and I thought Riz Ahmed, and I thought, my God, he knows what he's talking about. He was born here, went to Uxbridge, did brilliantly. Now has been nominated for 4 Oscars. People still ask him, you know, his right to be called British. Mm. This is, you know, this is the only country he knows. So this is just interesting that, you know, I think that I hope more people have the experience that I have had, where my identity, my culture, and my ethnicity has not been questioned in the work I do. But this is very unusual. I see others always constantly being asked this.
You made a good point there, because when I started protesting 2 years ago, technically I'm from Gibraltar, which is also a British country. So I was born and raised there. I have a British passport. Yet people just automatically assumed that I wasn't British just because of my skin color. And people kept asking me, saying, why are you in this country? You know, go back to your country. And I was like, my country is still part of still part of Great Britain. I don't know what you're talking about. So it's a very interesting point you made, that you were very firm in who you were and the beliefs that you stand for. And you made sure nobody, you know, took you for granted at all.
I think it's a lot easier if actually you are accented, you were born somewhere else. I think that it's really hard, second generation, third generation kids. I know that's much harder for my son. And it will be for my younger one when he goes to university. You know, identity will be an issue. But I don't think my husband faced this at all. And I haven't faced this whole idea of hostility because of who we are. I think it helps that we are, you know, we were born somewhere else. We had another life somewhere else. I think that makes a big difference.
So Asma, did you study law before you got married, or was it something you went into after you came to the UK?
I studied law when I moved to the UK. I did history as my first degree, history and politics as my first degree. And then I moved to this country, and then I sat it out for a bit because Thatcher had changed the rules. You basically had to pay foreign fees if you were not British. And I didn't want to pay that kind of money for an education. So I just sat it out for a bit. I applied to study law at Cambridge. I got in, but then I eventually didn't end up studying at Cambridge and transferred to London because my husband decided to move to London. And I had really bad memories of my first move to Cambridge. And I just remembered the isolation and being alone in Cambridge. I don't want to go through that. And I thought that, you know, even though it was quite exciting as the first person in my family to have got into Oxbridge, I thought this is like, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm going to make my own destiny. I'm not going to be worried about badges and, you know, what the world thinks. And I moved to London and I did my law degree at King's College London.
What was the time like then? So how many years was it between you, the point you got married and then when you went into your PhD?
I got married in 91. I began my law degree in 96, so I had an undergraduate degree in 99. I finished. I had my child in 99. So I was pregnant, 5 months pregnant when I was doing my final exam in the law school. And then I took a break for a short time. I began my PhD pretty soon after that, but I dragged it on for a long time because I kept taking time off because I had a second baby. I took a break from the PhD. I went part-time and I got my PhD in 2012. So that's the timeline.
So in those 5 years between the point of you getting married and you going into your studies again, I mean, what did you do for those 5 years in a country so far away from home, in a country that's so cold, so different to what we're used to?
No, it was those 5 years when I didn't know how to cook, and I was learning how to cook and learning what it was to be in this country, which I found quite difficult and quite challenging. I was very lonely in the beginning. I didn't have any friends. So it was that time that I learned to cook. And then I went into the degree because I never imagined, you know, you didn't have someone like me at that time. So I didn't think that food could be a career. Whenever you looked on food media, food television, even restaurants, there was
your mother had a career in the food industry.
Yeah, but not in this. And I knew that she could do it there.
Yeah.
You didn't see anyone like me here. So I didn't think that this was something that I could do. So I tried to do, which is a very South Asian thing. You either become a doctor or a lawyer. That's the kind of, you know, the way to get respect in your community. I thought, yes, my mom is going to be very impressed and my father. I'm going to get study law and become a lawyer. And that's why I started.
When you were starting your supper clubs, I remember watching an interview and you were saying how your husband wasn't aware of everything that was going on. You were sort of trying to hide it away from him. How did that feel at that point as a South Asian wife and a mother? It kind of goes against all the beliefs that we're raised with, that we should do everything with honesty and integrity, especially towards our husband, and have that loyalty. How did you feel at that time? I mean, what was it like to live your dream at the same time, but also having to hide it away from the people you love the most?
I have to say, I didn't think too much about that. I know that's the honest answer. I was so excited that I was cooking and I was having such a good time. The fact that, you know, this was not really the correct way to do it didn't quite occur to me till a little later. Then I did feel guilty. But in the beginning, it was just this excitement of, you know, just having this great opportunity to cook was too exciting. I know that's quite a bad thing to say, but that's how it was. That's the honest answer.
But you had a similar moment, I would say, when you'd opened your first restaurant in Soho, and you'd mentioned that your son was, I think, studying his GCSEs at the time, and you're worried about his grades. And you said, look, I need to just wrap everything up and be at home with my children. Did you feel at that time that your mother's instincts came in and then you just had to put everything away because you were so close to just wrapping everything up and all your hard work you were just going to put in a box and just move on with your life?
Well, I mean, to be very honest, I have not been the most reliable and trustworthy wife, but I am very South Asian when it comes to my children. And I was quitting. I quit the pub to come back home to write the GCSE notes for my son, because I could not allow my ambition and my success to come above the future of my children. So on this one, I picked my kids over my career. And I think that every time I will be at that crossroad, I will invariably pick, I will pick my children over my own success. And this is to do with being South Asian, to be being mother. But I also feel that the reason I'm continuing to work and I see less of them, because I bring in a lot of other things into the family, just, you know, financially as well, that, you know, I'm able to contribute to a lot to the family income because of what I do. But I also know that they are very proud of me. I notice my son, of course, I'm not allowed to follow him. They're not on Facebook. But I notice every time I put up a post, I hope he doesn't hear this, but if he does, he does. But every time I put up a post on Instagram or Twitter, the first person who likes my post is my son.
Aww.
And he always writes to me saying, I saw you, I heard you, I'm so proud of you, I'm so proud of you. And this kind of thing, my younger one is, I realized, was born for social distancing. I just didn't know what the word was before the pandemic. He's very low slung, doesn't like to hang around with people, doesn't communicate. He's this kind of intensely intellectual child. He was born a shrunken old man, a professor. He was born that way. So he's just a kind of, just doesn't communicate. He's aware of what I'm doing and is quite proud of what I do, possibly. But the older one is much more communicative and is very proud and does say it.
Asma, I know that from your upbringing and just as a South Asian woman, we tend to be quite emotional, especially after growing our family and having children. I can see that in myself as well. And I can see that as how it's changed me as a doctor when I see patients and their relatives. I know that when you started your supper club, all the women who you brought along with you to start your restaurant, these are women who've been through their own trauma and their own past. And, you know, they've had really difficult lives, but you've managed to change that around for them. What's it been like to try and sort of create a boundary as well? Because apart from being their closest one, their sister, their relative, their family, you're also, to some extent, you're also their boss and you have to try and control everything. How do you find that balance, especially in a kitchen which is so incredibly busy?
It's not easy, and sometimes I do struggle. I think that I do err on the side of being far more lenient and letting go and not pushing them harder than I know that if there is a pushback, I will give in. You know, the perception, I think that doesn't make me a weak leader. It makes an empathetic leader. When I know that, you know, so many women may do things, and you know this very well as well, that they feel is dangerous, that is not safe, that is not what makes them comfortable. They are put outside their comfort zone. I don't want to be party to that. So there are times when it's very challenging and it does mean that, you know, I get a lot of flack from someone else because of, you know, something that didn't happen or I didn't deliver, but I would not coerce them into doing something. It's a really good question that you asked, and no one has asked me this before. It's not easy. It's a very fine line I have to walk between, you know, getting them to be, you know, to understand that this is something that they have to deliver, to forcing them to, you know, comply with something that they are pushing back on. It's not easy. And most of the time, almost invariably, I have to give in. But it's always for the greater, because I have noticed that then they will make a bigger effort in some other aspect. And so it's always the, you know, this balance of give and take. This is non-verbal, you know, and this is part of maybe our culture where we do this, because we are not, you know, instinctively, South Asian women don't sit and open up their hearts and have this kind of long, you know, heart to heart, you know, for us, even now, going to therapy is considered really kind of an admission of weakness. Yeah. You know, our culture is really weird when it comes to this thing that you are going to talk about your problems. We don't talk about our problems. We just internalize it and we suffer. This is a cultural thing. And I think that in the kitchen, we are getting a lot better at communicating issues that are bothering us. And this is how I still have started off in 2012. It's been, you know, many years and we are very, very close. And we are able to do this give and take without this kind of big blowout conversation about, you know, you did this and I did this and I'm not happy with this. This doesn't happen that much, but there is a give and take. But I would not actually take them on and force them to do things because, you know, I know that they've already made a very long journey from where they were to where they are. This is remarkable. And this itself stops me from pushing them further.
Wow. This kind of leadership quality is not normally seen in the culinary world, is it, Asma?
No, it's not. And it should be. It should be. We should be far more empathetic. I think that we have for too long worshipped on the altar of the demon, traumatized, foul-mouthed chef, invariably white, screaming. Some people have made a fortune on this aspect of their personality. The demeaning and the humiliation of people who work around them has been watched by voyeurs on primetime television. And everyone thinks this is how it is, and this is how you become famous. And it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, you are this kind of crazy, erratic, mad person. You'd make everyone's life hell. You throw burning, you know, food across the place. You burn people. You put two slices of bread on a woman's ears and shout at her. And people applaud because they think this is showing leadership. And the ones who actually are empathetic and there's a softer side and there is a desire to try and bring everyone up with you, that you rise by lifting others, this is not celebrated. You don't see this on television and you don't see it anywhere. So what is your understanding of what's happening in the kitchen? You sitting on a dining room, the food just comes to you in this beautiful plate and presented to you. You don't know what's happening behind. It's the cameras that are behind in kitchens that are telling you what you think is happening in the kitchen. And what you see is horrific. And that's the problem, that then leadership is linked and success is linked to aggression, to male aggression. And sadly, I have said this many times, that powerful women who have got Michelin stars, who are, you know, have accolades, keep silent when there are evidence, proven evidence of abuse, sexual harassment, racism by male chefs. They close ranks with the chefs. I have never seen a female chef who's got a Michelin star talking about bullying and racism till now. And I have called them out every time. No one has even responded to me on this one. And this is a sad thing. They see themselves as female, as chefs and as leaders. Maybe they don't see themselves as females. I am sorry, I do. And I expect you to speak up. When young girls get sexually harassed and it has been proved and people lose their jobs because of racism and abuse and you are still silent, what signal are you giving to the women who work with you and to the men who work with you that this is all right? It's really awful.
Wow. That's really eye-opening, Asma. I think what you're creating now is a sort of revolution in the culinary industry. And I guess you probably understand that the changes that you'd like to see in this world of cooking and kitchens, you might not be able to see in your lifetime, but I believe that you've definitely sown the seeds to at least start to create that change. Do you feel like in the last decade or so, since you've been through this process, especially in the last 2 years, I'd say, Asma, when we've had the pandemic, we've had lots of social movements happening with Black Lives Matter and all the things we've seen around the world. Do you have more hope for the future now that more people will speak up and speak truth to power?
I am much more hopeful for the generation of your daughter. I am not doing this for myself or the women coming behind me. I am clearing the pathways for your daughter so that she doesn't even see the hurdles that you and I hit, that you and I still carry the scars of all the hurdles that were put in front of us, that we fell on, that we overcame, that we became victorious. I don't want your daughter to even fight this battle. I want her to have run an equal race. You and I are not running an equal race. We are carrying burdens of cultural expectations. We are jumping over hoops that the person next to us is not jumping because of the color of their skin and their background. This is a fact, and I'm not afraid to say it. I want to see an equal race being run where everybody, respective of the color of their skin, their gender, who their mother is, where their grandfather was born, should not matter. That their excellence is all that matters. I want to see that race, and I will not be alive when that happens. But my God, at least in my lifetime, I will remove every hurdle I can. I feel the breath of the girls, the age of your daughter, behind me. I need to clear. And every day, I live one day less. So I'm very aware of this. So this is why I'm unafraid. My bravery and my courage is not something inherent that is deeply. I pull myself up from my bootstraps because I know I don't have that much time left. And I am leaving a legacy that will live after me. And this is very important for me. So I speak up not because I want to be controversial, or I speak up because I feel it so deep inside me. But I'm speaking for those who may not even be born as yet, but they will know that someone made a difference to their lives.
Asma, when we came to Covent Garden, when your restaurant had just opened up, I remember just before leaving, we had a brief chat and you said to me, you know, anything is possible, Meenal. I'm probably one of the only people in London, and maybe even the United Kingdom, who's opened such a big restaurant in the middle of a global pandemic. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about the challenges you face, because, I mean, apart from being in a global pandemic and being in lockdown, and obviously you had the issue of customers walking through the door, so that was one thing you had to worry about. But what was it like financially to have to build something so big and then have to change your plans almost every few months because we just weren't sure what was happening?
It was extremely hard, but also very exhilarating. I will go in and I will make a difference to someone around me. I will do something good. I literally did that, that if the sun set, I wanted to know that I'd done something good. I started just without looking at the bigger picture, because the bigger picture was frightening, so scary. You know, I understood that it was spreading like mad. I completely, you know, there was no vaccine at that time. You know, no vaccine had been developed at the speed that this one was, you know, people were working on. I have a lot of faith in medics. I know that, you know, people will do something. If you throw enough money at it, something good is going to come up. But it was a very, very bad time. But I wanted to come through this with my entire team alive. I protected them. I made sure that their families, we lost no one, you know, no relatives. When Asian community, especially those, like at least five of my women who work in the kitchen, live in three generational houses, you know, we didn't lose anyone. And we managed to survive through this time. Financially, it's been beyond debilitating. It's been very tough. But I got the opportunity to move to a bigger space because of the pandemic. I had to wait for men to fail, male white chefs to fail, to be given a place this big. But now that we are seeing the end of the pandemic, I don't see myself in this place for too long, because I want to go back to my roots. I want to move to a smaller, more intimate space. I want them to feel that they came to my home. So, you know, I have to kind of rethink everything. But, you know, this space is very big. And, you know, once business rates kick in and pull back, it's going to become a challenge. But for this pandemic, it gave me the open space to give my team, you know, a safe space downstairs. We spread the tables out. We could do, you know, when we couldn't actually get people into our dining rooms, we could do takeaway. We had the deli. So it's been absolutely brilliant. It allowed us to survive. It allowed us to thrive, not just survive. But now I need to think of the next step, because I think, you know, moving water is always very inspirational for me. it keeps moving ahead, keeps moving ahead. And I think, you know, we all need to think that way, that, you know, time is limited. You know, you've got to carve out your way forward, keep moving forward. You know, don't just kind of sit back on your laurels and sit back on your success and think, oh, I've been successful. Challenge yourself, go somewhere new. So I think I will probably be moving.
Asma, I remember during the pandemic, you posted a few photos of your family home in India, and you really missed them very dearly. When you were writing this cookbook, did you manage to go back and visit your mom again and go through the recipes with her? What was that process like?
I couldn't. I have written this book in the pandemic, over 2 years, where I didn't see her. I spoke a lot to her. Again, you know, pretty much like the medics who came up with the vaccines and all the doctors who saved so many lives. I'm grateful to the techies who have come up with technology where you can communicate across oceans at no cost. And yeah, I spoke to her a lot. I couldn't have written this book if it hadn't been for the pandemic, because in the silence of staying at home, I was able to think of my past and everything that Ammu had done and her business, and realized how similar she was to me. Till then, I hadn't made that connection, which is ironic. I hadn't made the connection that I was like my mother. My mother, I always felt, was so iconic and had done such a great thing. I didn't think anything like, you know, that I'd learned anything from her. I had actually absorbed so much from her. Also, you know, I mean, you have a small child, so you're with your child all the time, but my kids, you know, one had gone off to university, the other one was always going to school. Suddenly, I found myself as a mother, you know, cooking for these two children. You know, from 2012, I hadn't had any meals with my kids. Wow. And I, at some point, I was exasperated. I was saying, I'd much rather feed 200 people in my restaurant than these two boys. They were like, you know, oh, what else is there? I was like, you know, what do you mean, what else is there? I'm not running a restaurant. And literally, they were like, you know, oh, this is what we have to eat. Oh, I want to eat something else. It's like, oh, what do you think? I'm going to, you know, and they forced me to make lasagna, you know, from looking at a YouTube tutorial. I don't know how to make lasagna. I'm Indian. And, you know, you know, I grew up in India. We didn't do these kind of things. I never taught myself to make anything from a YouTube tutorial. I had to do it because my kid was like, you know, I want you to make lasagna from scratch. And then he didn't even help wash up. So it's really, you know, I think I got time to step back. And the last chapter is about me as Ammu, you know, and what it is to cook with my kids. And I also had time to think about, you know, loss, you know, holding on and letting go. As an immigrant, this is what we do. We hold on to some things, we let go of some things. You know, I remember the time when my son started speaking. He had a London accent. And I looked at him and I thought, you know, what part of him is me now? Mm-hmm. He sounds like a foreigner. And, you know, my husband and I were talking that day that, you know, then he went out to buy a duvet cover and came back with, you know, the Union Jack. And I just stared at it and I was thinking, wow, because he's got a different perspective on everything from me. Mm-hmm. I grew up in India. For me, the Union Jack means something else.
Yeah.
But not for him. And it just is fascinating that this whole journey that I've had to take. So basically, this book is divided into 5 chapters, 5 decades of my life. I'm 52, you know, starting off from all my childhood memories to, you know, learning to cook, you know, all the celebratory dishes that we have in our culture. Then slow cooked food that where I cooked to heal myself, you know, where I gave myself time to concentrate, put patience and love into dishes and give it time. And then the final chapter is, you know, stuff I make with my kids, not fusion food, but, you know, kids today, especially my older one is into boxing, doesn't want to eat carbs. You imagine, I'm South Asian. You know, I don't want to eat rice. I don't want to eat roti.
So definitely, you know, no biryani for him, Asma.
Yeah. No, and he just wants to eat the meat of the biryani. I was like, you know, what are you doing? You know, this. Why do you eat this way? But then I realized that, you know, I have to adapt because they don't eat the kind of way that I ate, you know, growing up.
Yeah.
So I had to adapt. And so there's a lot of, you know, recipes of, you know, meat or spinach and things that, you know, I wouldn't eat an entire dish of spinach, but my son does. Mm. And so, you know, I just having to learn to, you know, adapt to that kind of, you know, way of eating. So the last chapter is quite interesting for anyone, you know, who's got kids or, you know, who actually eats like this as well, you know, who wants to have less carbs and wants to eat, you know, more vegetables and meat. That's not me. I'm carb on carb. I will eat aloo and aloo with
You know, Asma, there's one thing I don't understand is the halwa puri dish. Like, why would you eat puri with halwa? I've just never understood that.
This is it's a cultural thing. And with chana on the side as well. So
yeah, so you're mixing Karachi, savory and sweet in one.
Yes, it is. It's a cultural thing. You know, in Karachi, this is a standard breakfast. You find this in Pakistan, but you find this in parts of UP.
Asma, as a medic, as a doctor, I'm like, there's so much carbs and fat and sugar in this. How can anyone eat this for breakfast almost on a daily basis?
No. And we have in winter, we have nihari, which is, you know, slow cooked, you know, meat with bones and, you know, really kind of heavy gravy with roti. Their South Asian cuisine is a misnomer, because when you look at the climate, and you know, you look at similar places, you know, like in the Mediterranean where it's hot, and you look at their diet, you know, and the salads and the thing. We don't do that. We don't have this kind of, you know, salad culture where you have, you know, lots of cool things. All our food is hot, and the climate is hot. We don't have any tradition of eating cool dishes. And you think, you know, what are we doing? I have not ever worked this one out. There has to be a kind of method in the madness, but I have not understood why we literally have, you know, except for yogurt, which is the only cooling thing that you have in our, you know, everyday kind of food. Just imagine what else you eat. Everything is hot.
That's very true. I've never thought about that.
I think about this all the time. Try to think, you know, who designed this? Who thought of this, that this is a really good idea? Just look at the food they eat in Greece, you know, or in parts of the, you know, Middle East or wherever. They have things that are, you know, like look at Lebanese food. They have a whole meze, which is cold. Do we? No, we don't. Everything is hot. Everything is piping hot. And everything is spicy. Of course, you know, spice is very good. It does cool down your body temperature. Chilies is actually very good for, you know, dealing with the heat, because when you perspire, you know, when the food is hot, you know, because of evaporation, you know, your skin cools, you know, so it's actually cooling in some ways, the spices. That I understand why we're having all these spices and chilies. But what I understand is the temperature of everything we eat is hot. We don't have this culture of having crispy salads, maybe because, you know, things don't survive in the heat. You know, everything wilts in the heat. So we don't have lots of greens, crunchy greens that we eat. We only get them in winter.
Well, Asma, if you ever find the answer to that question, please let me know. I don't think I'm going to sleep tonight now. Asma, your career and your life has been a big roller coaster of emotions and success and ups and downs. And I feel like you are, a lot of women, especially like my mother, who's watched Chef's Table, who's watched your journey, they're living their dream through you. And I think that's a very beautiful thing to see. And it's in a very positive sense. And my mom did say to me, she said, look, my mom loves cooking, just like yourself. She loves feeding people. My mom's very famous in Gibraltar for feeding almost everybody. And she says, look, if I ever had a bit of money, if I ever had a bit of time, I would love to do what Asma has done. But the fact that another woman of, you know, of Indian origin, my skin color, is doing the same, it makes me very proud and happy. And I'm sure you hear this all the time, but is there any one specific defining moment you feel has made the journey worth it, or a defining moment of your success?
It's a difficult question to answer, because I do encounter this a lot, where I see women of all cultures, you know, sometimes, you know, Colombians, you know, and Mexican, wherever there was an agrarian, you know, tradition, where women were left to be this kind of cook and never celebrated, never paid. I mean, just look at our example in South Asia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal. Every home you go to, it is a woman cooking. Every restaurant you go to in the East or the West, it's a man cooking. And this is the problem. People like your mother and me have always stayed at home, the healers and the providers of our own family, uncelebrated, behind the wall. And I very often do understand this when I meet people and women who come to my restaurant, and they are in tears when they see me walking into the room or I serve their table. I see it in their eyes, and some of them tell me that you know, that they feel that they were seen when they saw my episode. They felt the story was about them. And this happens quite a lot. And I will never tire of this. It is deeply humbling when people say this. I understand. It is that point, you know, when you get on stage and the spotlight hits you and you get to say your part and then you get off the stage. But while I'm here on stage and the spotlight hits me, in the dark auditorium, I see rows of women who should have been on stage with me. And this is what will drive me. And this is what I feel every time someone tells me that they feel seen looking at me. I feel at that moment she's on spotlight with me. So it's a really kind of, I don't answer your question, but it's hard to quantify what the moment is and how, but it happens a lot. So there's not just one moment. It happens repeatedly. And I still get that huge sense of gratitude that she, for that moment, was in that spotlight with me, that she saw herself in me. And I hope that, and I'm actually very sure that when they move on, there will be moments when they will find them that, you know, why should I accept this? Why don't I do this? And I think I have inspired women to feel from having seen my story that they can be me. And I hope, you know, in my lifetime, I will see women surpass me who have a similar story to mine, the color of my skin, my age, mothers, who will go on and achieve great things.
Wow. Thank you so much for your time, Asma. I cannot thank you enough for joining me today. I know how busy you are and you've got so many things to do with your new book out, but I feel so happy to be able to speak with you and I've learned so much from you. So thank you for joining me.
No, thank you so much. It's been great. And I hope to see you, your family, your daughter, everybody soon.
And you can show Radhika around the restaurant again. I don't think she remembers much. She was only about 4 months old at that time.
No, bring her back.
Yeah, I will.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in this week and taking the time to listen to my episodes. And of course, thank you to all my guests who show up and give me the energy and time to share their story. I've left the link to order Asma's latest book, Amu, in the show notes below, as well as all of her social media links so you can follow her. Before I go, if you haven't watched the series Chef's Table on Netflix, make sure that you do, because every single episode is so beautifully shot and created. And of course, Asma Khan's episode will allow you to appreciate her story and journey much, much more. So I'll see you all next week, where I'll be back with another guest and another story to share with you all.